Welcome to the fifth lot lecture on individuals and structure.
Okay, so we are going to continue our discussion of structuralism about individuals from last time. And maybe the best way to get us into that discussion quickly is just to focus on this slogan. The slogan, individuals are just positions in structures. Okay, that's the slogan that you can see as being behind mathematical structuralism, structural realism, Dasgupta's approach. This idea that individuals are just positions in structures in such a way that in some sense blocks a permutation amongst the individuals in the structure or a shift of all the occupants of space-time's position with respect to space-time, the whole diffeomorphism as a way of blocking these things being real distinctions. Points of space-time are just positions and structures, or individuals are just positions and structures. This is meant to block these corresponding to real differences. Question is how to make sense of this. So last time we talked about a few different ways. We first talked about anti-hexitism, the view that it's just impossible to permute the individuals within the qualitative structure. And there the comment was just the familiar postmodal complaint that we want some account of what individuals are or what the fundamental facts are that shows why it's impossible to permute individuals within the qualitative array. What is it about, what distinctively structuralist view about the nature of actual reality makes this statement about what's possible and what's necessary true? So we then turn to the bundle theory, the view that objects are just bundles of universals, and that is an account of what is ultimately going on at the fundamental level that blocks permutations, but it just isn't an inadequate account because it lacks an adequate account of relations. There was this linkage problem that I talked about. The bundle theorist's best approach to relations can accommodate linkage. We talked about eliminative structural realism. By the way, if you've got a handout, it's the same handout as last time, so you can in a bit you can just move ahead to the discussion of bare particulars. We talked about eliminative structural realism, and there the complaint was it's really not a theory, it's a statement of what the theory is meant to do. It's meant to be an individual's free account of fundamental reality, but there wasn't a particular such account provided. We talked about weak discernibility, and there I argued that doesn't lead to a distinctive account of what objects are like, that would make it be the case that permutations of objects is a distinction without a difference. And then we were starting to talk about bare particulars. So that's where we're going to pick up. So there the idea was start with a structure. That is, start with some objects, some individuals, having properties, standing in relations. But now just delete the properties and leave the structure. Leave the relations and the individuals. So we've still got individuals standing in relations, but we have taken out the individual's intrinsic natures. And I refined that a bit. I said the view is really going to be that the individuals don't have any fundamental monadic properties. In any case, the intuitive idea is you take the individuals in the structure and you at least delete their intrinsic features. So they're all just featureless points. And I spent some time at the end of last lecture saying that this is perfectly good metaphysics. So you encounter, especially in the literature on structural realism, a concern that the objects would be too thin to be real, or they wouldn't be individuated, or that we would need to bring in hexaities in some objectionable sense to give them enough reality to support the relational structure. And I argue that those are misguided concerns because the view is that the concepts, the object theoretic concepts on this view, object concepts like there being something or the names of predicate logic, are fit to be present in a fundamental description of reality. And given that you think those are fundamental, there's no need for hexaities to underwrite the basic facts. Facts just of the form RAB are fundamental facts in this view. That's a perfectly coherent metaphysics. So I think that, so now moving on, I think that bare particulars provide, I think bare particulars is perfectly good metaphysics. I just don't think it's structuralism. So, I mean, a hint that this is so is that that metaphysics you would have thought was the metaphysics that was accepted all along by just the simplest sort of Platonist about, say, arithmetic. So Platonist about arithmetic thinks that when we're talking about the natural numbers, we're talking about one particular omega sequence. We've got a first member 0 and a second member 1, a third member 2, and so forth. And our name, the 0 is a name for the first thing in that omega sequence that we're talking about. Now, in this picture, and there's a particular distinguished relation that structures that, the successor relation. And in this picture, there's no talk of monadic fundamental properties has been brought in at all. And it's a very natural view, I think, to fill out the picture by saying that these objects don't have any fundamental properties. They just have these fundamental relations. I mean, that's not a structuralist position, or I wouldn't have thought. So now, why isn't it a structuralist position? Well, for one thing, there's no deep block to permuting, for example, 0 and 1 in the structure that we're in the natural number structure. So we've allegedly made 0 and 1 and 2 and so forth mere positions in structure by deleting their monadic properties, but nothing, I mean, blocks the following two being distinct fundamental pictures of reality. Let A, B, C, and so forth name the objects in this structure that are structured by a certain distinctive relationship, successor. Now consider another description that is exactly like that, except A and B have been permuted. That is a perfectly good other description of a way reality could be in terms that the theory takes to be fundamental. Perhaps it's impossible that be true if it's necessarily true of the objects in the structure that they have, the positions in the structure that they have. But still, whether the second is possible or not, we don't have any internal barrier to the permutation. That is, no barrier within the terms that the theory takes to be fundamental, blocking the articulation of this permuted scenario. So insofar as you were unsatisfied with merely modal approaches to structuralism, you should think that this isn't a structuralist view either. There's also the other kind of thing that the mathematical structuralists didn't like is there being a real question as to whether the rational number 2 and the real number 2 are the same or different. I mean, but there just are two different descriptions in terms that this view takes to be fundamental of the way propertyless objects could be. One that is shaped like the rational numbers, and then one containing distinct objects that shape like the real numbers, structured like the real numbers, and then a second description in which those rational numbers are parts of the real numbers. So it doesn't look structuralist at all. And similarly, in the case of structuralism about, say, points of space-time, nothing in this account of points of space-time blocks there being a difference between a world containing the actual world, space-time, and another world in which two points have been permuted. So the account just isn't structuralist. Okay, so what went wrong? And the thing I want to talk about next in the handout is ground and monism. So what went wrong is this. When we started with a structure, things having properties and standing in relations, and we deleted the monadic properties of the things, we didn't delete enough, because what the structuralist really wants to do is not just delete the features of the individuals, but delete their individuality or their identities as well. And you can read in a lot of what structuralists write, talk like this, that they want to delete the identities or individualities as well. So I've got a quotation from Resnick's book on mathematical structuralism. So he says, in mathematics, I claim, we do not have objects with an internal composition arranged in structures. We have only structures. The objects of mathematics are structuralist points or positions in structures. As positions in structures, they have no identity or features outside the structure. So the features, we remove those to get to bare particulars. Looks like we have to remove is also the identity of those things. We don't want objects with identity outside a structure. And you can find similar things, for example, in Leydig, saying that the reason objects are just positions and structures is they don't have any identity or individuality except within the structure. And the thing is, this talk about things, on the face of it doesn't make any sense. This is saying things don't have identity outside of structures. I mean, just taken literally, is this saying that the identity relation is somehow relativized to structures? And I'm not even sure what that would mean. I don't know what individualities are. I mean, I'm just taking these things literally. So in what sense might things be said to have individuality only relative to a structure? The claim that things don't have identity or individuality outside of structures, it's not a way of making precise the vague slogan that objects are just positions and structures. It's just another slogan which itself needs to be articulated. I mean, there's a kind of picture there, but we need something precise behind the picture. And one way of making it precise, sort of the most obvious or natural way, doesn't get us anywhere beyond where we've already gone. So here's a way of making sense of this. Fundamentally, there aren't any individuals. There is some fundamental description of reality that is individuals free. And that the facts that could be stated in this individuals free fundamental language support making some kinds of statements about individuals, such as the statement that there is a structure of some sort. There are some individuals arranged in certain ways. That way of talking is going to be, in a sense, metaphysically not perspicuous, because the ultimate description of reality is individuals free. But nevertheless, somehow the idea is the individuals, the real fundamental description of reality will support certain statements about individuals, enough to say there are structures of certain sorts, but not enough to support there being differences between structures differing only by a permutation. So if we say RAB, and we change and say it's instead RBA, there isn't going to be, or some other descriptions of reality that differ only by a permutation. There isn't going to be enough in this imagined fundamental individuals-free language that could support that distinction. The corresponding statement in a fundamental language for those two statements is going to be the same. So the idea is, ultimately, there aren't any individuals, and what is true ultimately merely supports structural statements. The problem is, now we want to know what is that fundamental description of reality that's individuals free. Now we're just back where we started. I mean, we started with looking at these quotations from structural realists that suggest that we should just talk about relations without relata and have structures without the nodes in the structure. And what we're after is some kind of metaphysics corresponding to that. And the idea of, we don't get anywhere by saying objects have individuality, lack individuality outside of structures. We don't get anywhere by saying what that really means is ultimately there aren't any individuals. There's some fundamental account which underwrites certain statements about individuals, but not others. So how to move forward? Well, another idea is not that there is a fundamental account of reality that is individuals free, but rather the facts about individuals are grounded by the structure. So somehow bring in ground into the picture. And the thought goes, that'll help us understand what structuralism about individuals is. And you can find suggestions or hints of this kind of position in the writings of structuralists. So here I've got something from Shapiro in the case of mathematical structuralism. So Shapiro says, each mathematical object is a place in a particular structure. There's thus a certain priority in the status of mathematical objects. The structure is prior to the mathematical objects it contains, just as any organization is prior to the offices that constitute it. The natural number structure is prior to two, just as baseball defense is prior to shortstop, and U.S. government is prior to vice president. So, the most extreme position in this area is Jonathan Schaffer's monism. So, according to monism, all the arrows of grounding emerge from the same place, the cosmos, the big structure, the thing that contains everything else as a part. So everything is grounded in the cosmos, according to this kind of monism. And that's clearly in the vicinity of what the structuralists want to say. So this is in some ways a natural fit for the structuralists. I mean, maybe the structuralists don't want to say that there's just one big structure. They want to talk about different substructures of reality and say that those ground their parts. Maybe there's one could be a structuralist about certain domains but not others. But in any case, let's just start with the extreme view, because what I say about that extreme view is going to carry over to any sort of use of ground to articulate structuralism. So what I want to say is analogous to what I said against the interpretation of gnomic essentialism from lecture two in terms of essence. So there I imagine this way of saying what gnomic essentialism amounts to. The laws hold in virtue of the essences of the properties involved in those laws, like charge and mass. And my complaint was, this account is incomplete if we're trying to give it a fundamental account of reality, because it doesn't say what facts it is about charge and mass and so forth, or whatever the fundamental properties are, that give rise to the laws. The account just says something about their ultimate natures gives rise to the laws that govern them, but doesn't specify what that is. So I complain that this is an incomplete account, an unsatisfying account of gnomic essentialism. And I want to say the same thing here. I want to say, if the structuralist claim is just all the objects and all the facts of this complex array of facts that is the world that we experience, if they all just come from the cosmos, what is it about the cosmos in virtue of which it grounds all these things? What statement is there of the distinctive cosmos-level fundamental facts? What is the structure of the fundamental facts about the cosmos that gives rise to this complex array of things we experience? This is especially pressing given the way that Schaffer talks about ground. Because for Schaffer, ground is not a connection between facts, where we say the fact that I am sitting grounds the fact that I'm either sitting or standing. For Schaffer, grounding is a predicate relating to objects. So what Schaffer is saying is that there's the cosmos. And that object grounds me, grounds this room, it grounds all the other objects. It also grounds facts, like the fact that I am a philosopher, the fact that there is something that bears a certain relation to me, and so forth. I mean, just all the facts of the world are grounded in this dot here, the cosmos. And nothing is said about the nature of the cosmos that explains in virtue of what it does ground all these things. I mean, the same remark is going to apply even if you think that grounding always has to be a relationship between facts. If the view was that the fact that the cosmos exists grounds everything else. Because again, we wouldn't have been given any distinctive conception of what is going on at a fundamental level that could give rise to all this complexity. So, I see a certain kind of dilemma here. So, either the monist accepts the demand for there being some fundamental account of what is going on here at the fundamental level, what the cosmos is like, what the cosmos level facts are, that underwrites all these grounding arrows, or the monist doesn't. If the monist does accept that the need for these grounding arrows to be explained, then the view is just incomplete. We just haven't been given, we don't yet have an idea of what fundamental account of reality the structuralist might uphold, because we don't know what the cosmos level facts are looking like, and the monist is conceding that some such account should be given. On the other horn, the monist might just dig in and deny the need for there being an underwriting account of these grounding errors. And then the grounding, the relation of ground just becomes magical. It's this unstructured entity, this entity that has no, we're saying this entity doesn't have any fundamental mental features. There aren't, we're denying the need for an account of fundamental reality at the cosmos level. And nevertheless, there's this rich array of grounding relations that are just underwritten. That grounding relation is magical in an objectionable way, I'm saying. So to get out what's unsatisfying about it, think about an obviously unacceptable account of grounding. So suppose someone says everything in the whole world is grounded just by just a little particle over there in the corner. And so what makes it the case that there's a room with people structured exactly like this? That particle. What makes it the case that the fundamental laws of physics hold? That particle. That particle is claimed to ground everything. And what's wrong about that is that there's not enough complexity in that particle to underwrite all these states. And grounding shouldn't be such a magical relation that it holds unmediated by an account of the grounding facts or things. It might be objective, well, that case is very different from the alleged cosmos grounding everything, because the cosmos is this complex entity with internal structure and the electron isn't. But the point of view that's on the table right now is that complexity of the cosmos does not have to be recognized at the fundamental level. So at the fundamental level, the cosmos is just like the particle, an object with no further specification of its fundamental features or any other fundamental facts into which it enters. So, I mean, you might think that this complaint about a magical grounding relation would be less appropriate if the friend of grounding likes the further fact view or the further force picture of grounding. I mentioned that in the first lecture, where on one view the facts about grounding are themselves grounded, and on another view they're perfectly fundamental. So what if these are all regarded as fundamental facts? I mean, I don't think that's at all an attractive view about ground, but also this is barely looking monistic, because on this view, all these facts, the cosmos grounding this fact, the cosmos grounding this fact, all these facts are absolutely fundamental facts for the cosmos. So there's absolutely one fundamental fact for the monist. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the facts that the friend of individual, sorry, the pluralist, the non-monist accepts, and the facts that the monist accepts. I mean, those facts are embedded on the right-hand side of a grounding predication in every case for the monist. But still, the monist has got, there's a direct correspondence between the monist's view and the pluralist's view. So it seems barely monistic. And if the monist view includes facts about individuals being grounded by the cosmos as fundamental facts, also there's no block to permutations, because we can just state two permuted outcomes. Cosmos grounds description WAB and cosmos grounds description WBA. And if these are the kinds of facts that are taken to be fundamental according to the monist, we can articulate in that language distinct outcomes corresponding to a mere difference in permutation. Outcomes that differ merely by a permutation, but don't differ structurally. So, the ultimate complaint here is that the monist's account is underspecified. So, I mean, I don't think the monist is likely to go for this picture of grounding being a fundamental relation. I think the more likely account is they'll concede that the cosmos has some fundamental features that underwrite the grounding errors. And so really the main complaint here, I think, is that leaves the account underspecified. And it's important to appreciate when that's a good complaint and when it isn't, because I think in many cases of grounding, it's perfectly fine to make grounding claims while being neutral on exactly what specific metaphysics underwrites the grounding claim. So I talked in the first case in my discussion of Jessica Wilson, I defended grounding against her criticisms because I said, for certain purposes, it's important to have a statement like physicalism that's neutral on exactly what the underlying metaphysics looks like. We want to be able to state a position which says the mental depends somehow on the physical, where we don't say exactly how. Where grounding falls short is context in which we want to state some particular fundamental account. And that's what we're looking for here. What is a distinctive structuralist metaphysics? And leaving the account so neutral is just not finishing that that project. Also, there's a question about whether there is any satisfying account of what things might look like at the cosmos level. So, I mean, how would you think about what the fundamental facts look like for a monist? Let's approach this in terms of fundamental concepts. One natural idea is this. There are no fundamental concepts that apply at the sub-cosmos level. All of the fundamental concepts live up here. So there are fundamental properties of the cosmos, perhaps. Maybe there's an array of properties that are available to the cosmos. Maybe there are properties and relations of those properties. And I have in mind relations amongst the properties available to the cosmos that give those, that's the set of properties available to the cosmos, a structure. So what the monist has to work with at the fundamental level is a state space structured in a certain way, and a set of properties available to it, and a set of relations that characterize the structure of that state space. That's, and also, a distinguished point in that state space, the property, or properties, that's instantiated by the cosmos. And my concern there is the points in that state space, the properties, and we don't just have a few fundamental properties now, like a believer like a pluralist, a believer in small objects would have. We've got vast infinity of properties available to the cosmos, all the corresponding to all the points in the state space. Those things are looking very individual-like. It's likely that no particular one of those properties is going to behave in any distinctive way. The laws at that level are all going to mention just the structuring relations over the state space and not the individual points in the state space. So isn't a permutation of properties in this state space going to be also the kind of distinction without a difference that the structuralist doesn't want to recognize? But nothing in this account is giving us a way of blocking that being a distinction. So I think there's also a concern that there simply isn't going to be an attractive conception of what cosmos level fundamental facts would look like. In any case, I think the ball is on the monist side of the court. If we want an attractive articulation of structuralism out of monism, we got to give some account of what the fundamental monistic facts look like. And then we can look to see whether that really looks structuralist at the end. Okay. That is what I wanted to say about monism. Let me now turn to Shamikdas Gupta's quantifier general. Shamikdas Gupta's algebraic generalism and then a related view, quantifier generalism. So this is what I think is the best view from my perspective in the vicinity. So let's start with the bundle theory, because there's a sense in which Dasgupta is like a bundle theorist. Dasgupta, the objects that Dasgupta accepts are just universals. Well, that's like a bundle theory. Although Dasgupta doesn't make use of bundles of those universals or aggregates. Got universals. Now remember I mentioned that bundle theorists, when they're confronted with the problem that objects with the same bundle are identified, and so objects with the same properties are identified, bundle theorists often start doing things like building in relational properties. Well, at least if the objects have relational differences, then we can include in one object's bundle the property of, not just the property of being F, but the property of bearing R to something that is G. So relational properties. And I complain that without an account of how these relational properties function, we don't have, this isn't a legitimate theory. I mean, the way we normally explain what a, the way normally talk about relational properties, like the property of bearing art as something that is F, is by quantification over individuals. And if we're not to understand it that way, but we're still to make systematic use of relational properties in a bundle theory, we need some systematic way of talking about them and understanding what they are, some way of understanding the structure of the space of complex properties. That's what Das Gupta provides. So here's the way Das Gupta talks about them. And formally, this is exactly analogous to the variable-free formulation of predicate logic that Quine made popular in Variables Explained Away, which contains predicate functors, except that Das Gupta has term functors. So let me talk about that. So take the property of bearing R to something. Das Gupta would describe that using a term functor C put in terms of a name for the property R, the relation R. So Das Gupta would begin with a name for a relation R, like the relation of loving or whatever, and then stick in front of it a term functor. A term functor is grammatically an expression that attaches to a term, something that names an object, and yields something that grammatically is itself also a term. So that's a term naming a relation R. This is a term naming the relation bearing R to something. And this is a term which names the relation, the zero place relation, of something's bearing R to something. So this is a term functor which existentially quantifies away one of the places in the relation. So similarly, if F were a name of a property, this would be a name of the zero place property of something's being F. Das Gupta also has a predicate, a primitive predicate in his language, that he attaches to names of zero place properties like this to form sentences, and that predicate is obtains. So instead of saying there is an X, there is a Y, RXY, Das Gupta's surrogate for that is this complex property, the property of something's bearing R to something, as we would normally describe it, obtains. Das Gupta, though, would resist. I mean, there's a sense in which Das Gupta would say, that's a bad name for the property of something's bearing R to something, because Das Gupta doesn't accept individuals. He's happy that one can subsequently build talk of individuals on top of his language of term functories, this language where you have term functor and others that I'll mention briefly, and this predicate obtains. But ultimately, this is not to be understood in terms of or not to be defined in terms of quantification over individuals. This is a basic concept in his language, a fundamental concept in his language is this term functor, which lets him describe this algebra of lets him describe this algebra of complex properties, fundamental properties and relations like R, and then complex properties that are named by using term functors and names of properties. So, in addition to this term functor, this sort of surrogate for existential quantification, there are others. So he's got one that lets him form the conjunction of two relations, so a relation R and a relation S. There's a term which lets him form a name for the relation of, as we usually say, standing in R and standing in S. There's a term which lets you form there are term functors which let you do things to the argument places of relations, like add a vacuous argument place or rotate the places of a relation. So given a relation R, I don't even remember if this is the symbol he uses, but there's a relation of rotation that rotates the argument places. So when applied to a two-place relation, this would give the converse of the original relation. And put together, all these term functors, plus the predicate obtains, plus an array of names of relations, gives you, in a precisely definable sense, the expressive power of standard predicate logic without names. So take any sentence in standard predicate logic, like this, or there is an X, fx and rxy. There's going to be some translation of the sentence into a sentence of Dasgupta's term functories. And so given any scenario that one could describe using standard predicate logic with no names, Dasgupta is going to be able to come up with a term functory sentence that is, in a certain model theoretic sense, equivalent to it. Except for Dasgupta, they're not metaphysically equivalent, even though there's a structural parallel between the two languages, because this isn't committed to objects. This language of term functories. So here's some good things about this account. So first of all, it's explicit about what it's metaphysically explicit in a way that eliminative structural realism isn't. So we've got clear decisions as to what objects we're accepting, universals. We've got clear decisions as to what the concepts we're using are for them. One can say explicitly what kinds of statements in this language follow from others. It supplies the kind of linkage that was lacking in the bundle theory. So the bundle theory, remember, in the version that I said was the best attempt of the bundle theorist at accounting for relations, there was no distinguishing between this scenario and this scenario, where there's a relation R and a relation S, and we've got three things. And in the first scenario, R holds for those and S holds for those, and the other R holds and S holds of the first two. But Dasgupta can distinguish those situations because, I mean, he can just write down the Ramsey, begin by writing down the Ramsey sentence for the two situations. There is an X, there is a Y, there is a Z. X is not Y, Y is not Z, X is not Z, and R, X, Y, and S, Y, Z. And then, same thing for this one. They'll have two different translations into his term functories. And so the situations can be distinguished. The kind of linkage that, for a believer in individuals, is achieved by the recurrence of names in distinct facts. Like the believer in individuals would say, well, we have RAB and we have SBC. And the fact that it's B in both of those two facts, but in the second place, the first fact, and the first place in the second fact, establishes the linkage between those two facts. That kind of linkage is achieved by Dasgupta by using single complex sentences to describe the whole scenario. It's like the structure is like the recurrence of variables within the scope of a single quantifier for just standard predicate logic. So there's more structure in his basic language that lets it be adequate to describing the kinds of things one can describe in standard predicate logic. So also, there's a deep block to permutation. Permutations of individuals amongst roles and structures simply doesn't correspond to any kind of difference at all, because in a scenario, because structures in which objects, individuals' roles have been permuted share the same Ramsey sentence. So if we've got ABC versus BAC, so we've got RAB and SBC versus RBA and SAC. They share the same Ramsey sentence. There is an X, there is a Y, there is a Z, R, X, Y, and R, Y, Z. And this then gets translated into Dasgupta's term functories, into a certain sentence involving R and S and term functors. And that very same term functory sentence is going to be shared by these two descriptions in terms of individuals. So the permutation is a distinction without a difference in a very strong sense for Dasgupta. So, okay, before I move on to criticize that account, what I have to say against it is far less, by my lights, decisive than what I say against all the others' accounts, because I like this view, and I think this view has a fighting chance of being true. I want to mention a closely related view. So there's a simpler view, which is just the fundamental facts look like this. The fundamental facts are quantificational. So this is the view which says you can't use names in a fundamental language, but you can use quantifiers. And that kind of view also achieves linkage in the way that the bundle theory didn't. Much more likely to be adequate to giving a complete description of the world, clear, and blocks permutation. So that's another view. Now, that's a view which denies the existentialist principle that we talked about so much on the second day. So the principle that existentials are grounded in their instances, or there's a fundamentality theoretic analog of that principle which just says existential sentences are never fundamentally true. And so if you like those kinds of principles, you're a conservative of the logic of ground, or otherwise didn't like the idea that at the fundamental level there could just be these quantificational sentences. There are individuals playing certain roles, but no instances of those existentials being fundamental facts. And I have to say, that strikes me as utterly bizarre, but I don't quite know how to argue against it. In any case, if that strikes you as bizarre, you like the principle that existentials have to be grounded in their instances, you will prefer Dasgupta's account. I mean, if you really are confident that it is a genuinely different view, and you don't have the thought, oh, it's so structurally similar that what's the difference? So there's some issues there about whether the views are really different, or if they are really different, is it really important to preserve the existentialist principles that I'm not going to try to resolve. Okay. So two forms of generalism. Quantifier generalism and algebraic generalism. So my complaint about both of these views comes from a certain kind of holism about the views. So suppose we want to describe two systems. So we have a system RAB and a system SBC. And the quantifier generalist description of this is going to be, there is an X, there is a Y, RXY. And the quantifier generalist description of this is going to be, there is an X, there is a Y, SXY. And the description, though, of the combined system that consists both this and this, cannot just be the pair of the descriptions of the sentences of the systems individually, because it's leaving out something, that this is the very same as that. That was the problem with the bundle theory. The quantifier generalist, though, has a solution to this. The solution is you describe the two systems using a single sentence. There is an X, there is a Y, there is a Z, R, X, Y, and R, Y, Z. But in general, when we've got two systems or multiple systems, and we want to give, the quantifier generalist wants to give a description of those systems, a single sentence has to be used to describe the combined system. Because anytime you close the parentheses on one system and you start anew, there's no relationship being drawn between the variables in the second system's description and the variables in the first sentence's description. So the view is holistic. You got to describe the world at one go. The reason that's what I think is problematic about that is that it leads to strong ideological commitments when we want to describe worlds that are infinite. So suppose the world has a space with continuum, many points, and there's no special regularities in what's going on, so the fundamental facts are just going to have to consist in a description point by point in what's going on at all the points. And, pairs of point by pairs of point to describe the relationships between points and so forth. So the quantifier generalist looks like is going to have to describe that world with a single sentence, because the holism I'm talking about, using a single infinitary sentence. We're going to have a fundamental language that allows, I'm going to use numerical subscripts, but that's not right, because we need more than countably many of them. Infinite blocks of quantifiers, so continuum many blocks of quantifiers, and then we're going to have continuum many conjuncts in a single conjunctive sentence, or at least that many, to describe all the point-by-point facts about such a world. The fundamental truth about this world simply can't be described except in a fundamental language in this view, except by bringing in infinitary quantification and conjunction. And that's a big commitment. It detracts from the simplicity of a theory if you need to bring in these heavy-duty logical resources just to describe the fundamental facts about what's going on. The same is true for Dasgupta, except there's an extra issue there. Because of the parallel between a quantificational description and Dasgupta's description, he's going to have, it looks like, some kind of powerful infinitary resources in his theory, except it isn't clear that there is any term functories analog to infinitary quantification. So it's an open question, as far as I know, whether there's any natural-looking anyway language that stands to infinitary predicate logic as term functories, Dasgupta's sort, stands to standard first-order logic without names. I mean, the problem is that I couldn't make this clear without going into a lot more details about the term functors than I've gone into, but the problem is the functors that deal with monkeying around with argument places, so rotating argument places and adding a place, those are the ones that it isn't clear how they could be generalized to relations with infinitely many places. In any case, as far as I know, that's just an open question as to whether there is any natural such analog to infinitary predicate logic. So, okay, but back to the concern that extra logical resources are needed. Why is there a difference here between these forms of generalism on the one hand and the believer in individuals on the other? The difference is this. It's again the linkage that the recurrence of names in distinct sentences plays, or the recurrence of objects within distinct facts plays. It's the role that that recurrence plays for the believer in individuals that is played in a different way for the generalist. So for the believer in individuals, to describe an infinite world, we don't need infinitely long sentences. We just need infinitely many small sentences. You've got to have, I mean, if you're thinking of this linguistically, you've got to have an uncountable vocabulary because you've got to have a name for each point of space-time. But none of the sentences themselves have to be infinite, so there isn't the need for these kinds of logical resources that's needed by the quantifier generalist. Or just think of it in terms of facts. You just got infinitely many facts, and the binding or the linkage is accomplished by the recurrence of individuals amongst those facts. Whereas for the quantifier generalist, the relevant linkage has got to take place within the single fact. And so that fact has got to have, continuing to take this issue at the non-linguistic fact level, it's got to have a constituent for infinitary quantification and a constituent for infinitary conjunction. So the argument is presupposing that there is something worse, more destructive to simplicity, worse from the point of view of parsimony, about these logical, extra logical resources than just accepting infinitely many individuals. Because the believer in individuals accepts infinitely many individuals. And I'm saying that that's a better theory than this theory that requires infinitary quantification. And this kind of assumption is very like a commonly made assumption, although not undisputed, amongst metaphysicians anyway, that quantitative parsimony is less important than qualitative parsimony. It's less important to minimize the number of individuals you accept, and more important to minimize the number of kinds of individuals or the number of fundamental properties of individuals one accepts. I think both of those are correct. That number of individuals matters less than either kinds or the kinds of logical bits of ideology one needs. And I think part of this has to do with their differing role in the laws. So individuals are all alike with respect to the laws. The laws don't say, Joe, you do such and such, but Callie, you do so and so. The laws are general, and so all the individuals are alike as far as the law is concerned. Whereas you posit a new kind of particle, that goes along with positing a new distinctive law that governs it. And bringing in a new kind of a bit of logical ideology itself means bringing in distinctive logical laws that govern its behavior. So I think this dogma of quantitative parsimony counts less than these other kinds of parsimony can be supported by thinking about the differing roles in the laws of individuals and other kinds of concepts. I also think, and this is something that I'll talk more about at the end if I have time, there is this elusive sense that parsimony just can't be a mere matter of counting the number of undefined concepts one has in one's theory. There's this old discussion that Goodman had in The Structure of Appearance where he points out that you can always artificially reduce the number of primitive concepts you've got. You know, if you've got two primitive relations, you can just replace them with one primitive, long-replaced primitive relation that encodes the first two. There's got to be some sense we make of evaluating individual bits of ideology for their complexity. Intuitively, are the facts that the one bit of ideology generates or takes part in thereby more complex than the other? And intuitively, these infinitary concepts are particularly destructive of simplicity because they enable the formation of such complex facts. But, that's all a very hard, murky area. But in any case, that's my main complaint about quantifier generalism and Dasgupta's account. It's that because of their holism, they require very strong logical resources at the fundamental level. So I want next to talk about Dasgupta's argument again, because this objection I'm making is a very defeasible one. I mean, this is an objection for which the Lewisian language of it's a cost, but maybe it's outweighed seems appropriate. Because we make these assessments of which theory is better by judging how the theories stack up overall according to the theoretical virtues, and parsimony is one of those that can be outweighed by other things. So I think we should revisit Dasgupta's argument. And there are some distinctive things to be said about that argument from the perspective of fundamental concepts, but I need to assess how much time I have. So when did we start roughly? Does anybody remember?
I think it was like 8 minutes past.
8 minutes past. Let's see what I can say in 8 minutes. So, remember Dasgupta's argument. He says, absolute velocities, we all agree, should be jettisoned from classical physics because they're undetectable and redundant in a certain sense. Same argument, though, shows that individuals should be jettisoned because they're also undetectable and redundant. Just as if you give everything a velocity boost at one time, everything's going to look exactly the same except for the absolute velocities. Similarly, if you give a time slice a permutation and then follow according to the laws to later slices, everything's going to look the same except for a permutation. So let's separate these two complaints, a complaint about undetectability and a complaint about redundancy. So from a certain realist perspective, the complaint about undetectability just isn't going to be, my perspective, just isn't going to be compelling at all. The mere fact that a theory implies that certain other facts are unknowable in general is no sign that anything is not on its own a strike against that theory. I mean, that's sort of realism 101. You know, you're realist, you think that there are facts of the matter that we could never know about, like what's going on outside our light cone, or the little green people that appear every time I turn my head, and everyone else turns their head, and so forth. So, now, Dasgupta's complaint about, Dasgupta doesn't in general complain about unknowable facts. He says this particular kind of unknowability is bad, and he delineates the kind he's talking about very carefully. But still, the fact that unknowability in general is no problem for the realist leads to the question, well, then what's so special about this kind? I mean, why should the fact that absolute velocity is undetectable on its own be any strike at all against Newtonian space-time? It can be a sign of something else wrong. Often, if there's a systematic way in which a theory yields these predictions that you just can't test, that's often a sign that there's something wrong in the theory that has nothing to do with epistemology. It's a sign that the theory has got some wheel that's turning without doing anything. But this realist says, that's what I care about. If you have unknowable facts or undetectability, that's what the sense, we should look to see whether the theory has some other flaw, whether this has pointed us to some purely non-epistemic flaw. So that leads me to think that the real concern that I care about in Dasgupta's case about individuals is the redundancy concern. The idea that just as absolute velocities are redundant to the laws because they're not appropriately integrated with the rest of the laws, because the absolute velocities at one time, given the dynamics, only affect the absolute velocities at a later time, so they're redundant in the laws, so there's a non-epistemic flaw in the laws. So individuals share that same non-epistemic flaw, and the fact that they're undetectable is no strike on its own against individuals, but rather, at best, it points to a non-epistemic problem. That's the argument that concerns me most. But now, there's something distinctive to say about that kind of argument from the point of view of a realist about fundamental concepts. So, the concern about redundancy is that there is a part of the law, there's a part of the theory that isn't properly integrated with the rest of the theory and the laws. That's the wheels that turn but don't do anything metaphor. We look at the laws in a theory that contains some redundant structure, and we see that there's some part of the theory that's just not doing anything, not properly integrated with the rest, and it can just be deleted without loss. Or it can be deleted making minor modifications elsewhere that yield a theory that just looks better from the point of view of the theoretical virtues. The thing is, it's not at all clear that that can be done in the case of individuals, and leading to Dasgupta's term functories. Because what Dasgupta, individuals are integrated with everything the theory says. Everything theory says sort of a standard predicate logic construal of the nature of the theory is shot through with individuals taught right from the start. And so what Dasgupta is proposing in moving from an individual's metaphysics to his term functories metaphysics is not a deletion of a bit of structure in the original theory. It's rather a replacement or exchange of one kind of structure for another. So the important thing from a... And so it may be that that's a good exchange. I mean, then we have to look and see whether a term functories reconstrual of a given physical theory or a given overall theory of the world looks better from the point of view of the theoretical virtues or whatever maxims we think are relevant to choosing a theory. And that is the crucial thing, though, is it isn't as if we've taken one theory and just scooped out the individual's structure, but left in the rest, because the individuals permeated the entire theory. Rather, we rewrote the entire theory in terms of these term functors rather than with quantifiers. So here's why the realism about individuals, realism about fundamental concepts is relevant to this issue. For the realist about fundamental concepts, a theory has a distinguished formulation. There is a distinguished set of fundamental concepts, and depending on how realist you are about laws, a distinguished way of formulating the laws in terms of those fundamental concepts. And a judgment that there is some redundant structure has to be understood in terms of that distinguished formulation. You can't just say, well, a theory has an aspect, the individual's aspect, and then think that that aspect can be just scooped out, leaving everything else intact. Because that aspect may not correspond to an element in the distinguished formulation. So this though leads to real questions about how we ever make judgments about excess structure. So I think I am going to stop in mid-sentence and say that there's a lot more to say there, but I'll restrain myself. That's it. Sorry.